With ruthless energy, the Nazis imposed their domination over all the power structures of the country. They set up parallel Nazi organisations shadowing the key state offices and ministries. Nazi stormtroopers marched into courts and turned Jewish judges and others who resisted them in any way off the bench. At the May Day rally in 1933, Hitler spoke, reassuring workers of his respect for their rights. Next day, Nazi stormtroopers occupied the offices of trade unions and sent their organisers into concentration camps. Goebbels rallied students in huge orgies of book burning. The Nazis took over the centres of learning. They even convoked the Brown Synod, which delivered the hierarchy of the Lutheran Church into their hands. When Hitler took the next step, outlawing all political parties other than the National Socialist German Workers' Party, Social Democrat deputies joined their communist colleagues in concentration camps or fled the country. German radio delivered a stream of hysterical propaganda. A bloody communist revolt with hundreds of casualties, while the Austrian government had lost all control. In reality, everything was quiet, save for Nazis beginning to show themselves. Shortly before midnight, President Miklas appointed Seyss Inquart Chancellor. Goering now told Seyss Inquart to request the assistance of German troops to restore order in Austria. Seyss Inquart, still not aware of the part he was required to play, protested, "Well, that's one thing I need not do because everything is quiet here in Austria so far." The only threat to peace and quiet on the streets were the Nazis themselves. The Germans ignored him, announcing that he had invited German troops to enter the country. At dawn, on the 12th of March 1938, at many points along the frontier, German troops crossed into Austria.
Tonight the world trembles, torn by conflicting forces.
The shadow of the goose-step falls on Austrian soil.
Centuries-old boundary has been obliterated, and anxiety shifts to a new region.
As German troops swarm across frontiers in their first offensive since 1914.
There were scenes of enthusiasm, and from the balcony of the Chancellery, Dr. Seyss Inquart, the man appointed by Hitler, saluted in answer to the greetings of the crowd.
Even small children have learnt the Nazi salute.
Seyss Inquart was Chancellor of Austria for less than 2 days. The new Austrian government passed a law that made Austria a province of the German Reich. The SS arrested Schuschnigg, who would not be freed for more than 7 years. Hitler made his triumphant entry into Vienna. Even as the celebrations took place, the new regime began its mass arrests, and the former Austrian Minister for War was assassinated. Stief then made a plan to kill Hitler at an inspection of uniforms. The brave officer modelling the uniform, in which explosives could be secreted, would blow up Hitler and himself. The idea was sound, so Klaus sought a soldier prepared to make this sacrifice. He found a much-decorated officer, Major Baron Axel von dem Buscher-Streithorst. Buscher had been scarred by the regime. A year earlier, Buscher found himself at Dubno Airfield in Ukraine. There he witnessed the Ukrainian SS in calm, orderly fashion compel Jews, including many women and children, to dig a pit, strip in the snow and lie face down. More Jews were compelled to strip and lie on the freshly killed or still writhing bodies of those in the pit. The SS murdered 5,000 people that day. and Buscher saw it all. Buscher knew these SS men were acting under orders. The initiative for mass murder of the Jews must have come from the government, to which he had sworn allegiance. Buscher was traumatized by this experience. He was determined to do anything in his power to remove Hitler and his regime, including assassinating Hitler. He told Klaus he could be counted on for the task. With the possibility that the assassination had failed, generals in Berlin pondered whether to throw caution to the winds and issue the Valkyrie orders anyway. Fromm might help if he thought the success of the coup was assured, but he could not be relied on while no one knew what had happened. Even Klaus might disown the action on his return. The generals dithered. Like a ghostly apparition, the real possibility of the war ending there and then floated before the officers in Berlin. They had only to reach out and grasp it. But they remained frozen with fear and uncertainty. The SS inadvertently helped the conspiracy by ordering their own blackout. Operators in the exchange were ordered to move their chairs back 1 meter from their consoles. Calls were ruthlessly cut off. With the Wolf's Lair blacked out, the communications network was available for the conspiracy. But the conspirators did not use it. In the Bendler block, Colonel Merz von Quirnheim was beside himself, sensing that there was no going back and urging immediate action. He relentlessly urged and cajoled his uncertain superiors, including the hesitating Olbricht, to strike. Instead, trying to maintain normal habits so as not to arouse suspicion, they went out to lunch. With the Gestapo's net tightening around him, Schlabrendorf was soon arrested and tortured. It began as he knelt, chained and helpless, with punches to the face. Outwardly calm, Schlabrendorf merely reminded his interrogator that such behaviour was vile and illegal. This only infuriated them more. Taken from his cell at night, Schlabrendorf was given a final opportunity to confess. When he refused, his hands were chained behind his back and fixed with a device that pressed pins against his fingertips. The turning of a screw pushed the pinpoints into his fingers. When his denials continued, he was strapped face down onto a rack. Cylinders were shoved over his bare legs. Inside were nails that pressed against his flesh. Here too, the turning of a screw pushed the nails into his legs from ankle to thigh. The rack was then expanded so that his shackled body was pulled in all directions. Still, Schlabrendorf refused to talk. He was savagely beaten.